Welcome to Talent Hub Talk. I'm Ben Duncombe, and on this podcast, I will be interviewing prominent and inspirational figures from both the local ANZ and global Salesforce Ohana. In today's episode, I'm joined by Lorenzo Frattini. Lorenzo is a Salesforce certified technical architect and the founder of Clayton, a Salesforce product business. We look back at Lorenzo's career, both before and through his Salesforce journey, and we hear a little bit more about the software engineering background that he has, and also talk about why potentially some software engineers are still a bit hesitant to work in the Salesforce ecosystem. We then run through Lorenzo's time with Tequila, I guess what attracted him to the business initially, and then what it was like to work with some of the greatest and smartest minds in the Salesforce ecosystem back when Tequila UK had some of the very, very best people around. We then look at his journey through consulting and what led him to go on to become an architect and then eventually pursue the CTA and pass the review board and what that journey looked like. We then hear a little bit more about Clayton and where the product idea came from, and then focus in on the Salesforce developer ecosystem, why code reviews are so important, and what some of the ramifications of poor code in a org actually can be for a business, and why it's so important to address that and make sure that good quality code is being written, and some of the steps that can be taken to ensure that by a business. We then look at some of the advice that Lorenzo would give an up-and-coming developer in the Salesforce ecosystem. Lorenzo has a huge amount of knowledge. He's a really, really great guy, and I really hope you'll get a lot from this episode. If you do, please do subscribe for future episodes that are coming through.
Lorenzo, thank you so much for joining us from what I can see in the background is a sunny England.
Yes, could you tell?
I can, which is rare.
It's good to be here. It's good to be back. I missed London, which is kind of strange, but for some reason, I keep coming back. I keep missing it when I'm away, so it's good to be here.
Well, I've managed to stay away. Although I've come back for holidays, I've managed to stay away for 10 years now, so I don't have that lure. But you've obviously spent some time recently back home in Italy, which is what you're referring to, coming back to London.
Yes, of course, yes, and of course, thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely, no, it's our pleasure. And just so I know, where would you class as home now? Is home Italy or is home the UK?
It's so hard to tell. I don't think I have one. I think I'm a kind of a nomad. I am split between two different places, which home for me is here in London. But of course, I have many reasons that, you know, friends and family. And I keep going back to Italy every now and then. And of course, that's something that in a way is home too, right? Is where you go back to.
Sure, I don't blame you. I love Italy. I can talk about Italy and the food all day, but let's get rolling on on Salesforce and your career. So look, I've got a lot of different questions to run through with you, and I'm keen to touch on different topics. But yeah. I always like to start before you even heard of Salesforce and understand a bit more about what you did in your earlier career and what you kind of wanted to be growing up.
Right. Okay. Wow. I studied in Italy, my university. I studied computer engineering. So after my master degree, I grew up dreaming working at Google, these kind of places, right, where I could see all these talented people. I was very fascinated about the Silicon Valley. Web 2.0, 2.0 was coming up. Was becoming a thing at that time. And I had this incredible drive toward everything about the technology space. But I was from Italy, and there wasn't at the time anything like that there. So I started, the closest thing that we had there was the company I ended up working with, which wasn't a product company, it was a consulting company. In Italy, and at that time, it's where, you know, the top talent would go. They had very, very high standards, hiring standards. So I kind of set a little bit of the challenge for myself, and that was my first job. So I worked as a consultant developer, a software engineer, in a technology consulting company. The technology I used to work with was Java, typically. And I was already there surrounded by very, very talented people, which is something that I've been very blessed throughout my career, actually. And that's something that was very, very, it's a big part of what I've become, actually, being surrounded by talented people. So that's what that's where I started. I basically started studying computer engineering, being fascinated about technology in general, and really trying to work in the best place I could, given, you know, my resources, where the best people were in my space, because it was a natural drive for me to become better.
Has that always been something, like, your consideration has been who you work with predominantly? Like, has that always been a big driver for you?
I think so, yes. So one, I mean, I think it's different for many people, and it's not always a single thing, right, that make you accept a job or look for a change in your career. But for me, learning and being surrounded by smart people has always been a big motivator. And I think this comes from the desire to improve myself and keep learning. I think that is a kind of a constant theme throughout my career. And it historically has taken a very big part in my decisions as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we've spoken to a lot of CTAs, and we'll get onto that journey. But that's one thing that is always a theme through the conversation, is the passion for learning and improving all of the time. And that must be a reason why these people have gone on, and yourself have gone on to be CTAs. And we'll go through that journey, but it's interesting that you touch on that point. So from the moment you got into the consulting business, you're working with Java. How long did you stay out of the Salesforce ecosystem before you got your break?
I think 5 years, 6 years, something like that.
So having been a software engineer for 5, 6 years, can you remember what you first thought of the Salesforce platform when you saw it?
Probably was something like, I'm never going to learn this. It felt immediately, straight away, it felt huge. So when I was first hired, the manager that hired me, he bet on the personality and the person he had in front of him, because I had zero knowledge of Salesforce. So he kind of trusted me. And clearly, I mean, in retrospect, it was a big bet for him, right? But he saw something in me, I think. He basically gave me the challenge and he told me, okay, you have the job, but I want you to learn this platform and I want you to earn your first certification. Pick one. I suggest you do the admin first and we'll put you on a course, but you'll have to learn by, I don't know, the first 3 months, and this will be your probation. And I think it's a common thing, but for me it was a very, it was a first. And so I was pretty much straight the first probably week of work. I was straight into this admin course. And I thought, oh my God, this is so huge. I'm never going to learn this. So that was my first exposure and my first impression. And as I started working with it, I started liking it and being impressed by other things, more about how this technology was really flexible and could really shorten, you know, the time to build something. And as an engineer, it was a kind of a wow moment, because I've been doing this with other technologies and building the same type of outcome, same type of applications, required much longer efforts. So that was my wow moment, I guess.
Sure. And it's interesting because we are still, even to this day, we still get some pushback when we're trying to bring software engineers into the Salesforce ecosystem. Your wow moment was that, you know, the Salesforce platform can make your life easier. But why do you think right now we're still finding that some software engineers are hesitant to work with Salesforce and transition into this ecosystem? And I guess we've had some people say, oh, it's not like the cool platform to work on, or if you want to make software. Yeah.
I think that the coolness factor is that this is not a platform for hackers, right? This is an enterprise tool, which is an entirely different thing. It's not something that as a developer you would first look into. It's not something for building. I mean, at least in people's mind, It's not something for, you know, building your garage startup. It's a big enterprise and, you know, premium expensive product. So that's what takes the coolness away. And then, so that's, I think it's probably that there is probably a little bit of that. And there is also an element of the fact that the technology, when you work with it, there are a lot of low code elements. And that tend to dissuade developers. So developers like challenges like playing, messing around with code. And the perception that this platform is built around a different concept, I think, takes a little bit of the coolness away. And probably there are also other things, like there are more modern paradigms now in engineering world that haven't been adopted yet by Salesforce. They are catching up, by the way. Things like, you know, functional programming or serverless. There are, well, some, say, technology trends that are cool. And as a developer, you might be tempted to prefer those type of technology to experiment with. And because Salesforce doesn't have them, it's less cool, right? But regardless, if you kind of set these prejudices out aside, there is a lot to like about it.
Sure. So did you ever have any reservations? You weren't going to be doing the development work that you kind of had set your career path on at that point?
No, I think not. What I quickly came to realize is that this was being used across a wide variety of industries. So even if it was quite a long time ago now, and Salesforce wasn't where it is today in terms of, you know, popularity, was immediately clear that this wasn't a system that was, you know, just used by a specific industry. And the common thing was that all the implementations, even the smallest one, were highly strategic to those businesses, right? So the driver for me was not really on the technology, was really, hey, this is for me an opportunity to stop working on, you know, project no one really cares about, and start to work on projects that are making or breaking a company. Because there are a lot of stakes and there is a big, big expectation about transforming this business entirely. And that was, for me, the fascinating part.
Sure. So you joined Tequila, and Tequila from, I spoke to Andy Mahood recently, and we ran through Tequila as a business and the kind of people you work with. Obviously, I know Seb well, and there's people like Gary Brevington here in Sydney. Like, there's just some amazing talent. Ben Edwards in New Zealand. There's some amazing talent that have come out of Tequila. So as soon as you got in there, did you then know that Salesforce was going to be a long-term play for your career? And also, you were around special people. Like, was that really obvious at that point?
So the first question, I never took Salesforce as a long-term bet. It was... For me, it was about growing and leaving my comfort zone. It was about learning something that was clearly up and coming, but was also challenging myself in ways that I wanted to. So learning about you know, everything that I mentioned earlier, being exposed to this type of project and as a consequence, having that kind of impact was a big factor for me. So that is an element. It was never a long-term decision, I thought. My kind of expectation was, I'll do this for a while and use this as an opportunity to learn something new. I was also, at that time that I moved to the UK, so there was also the element of learning a new culture, learning a new language. It was many, many different things that I was trying to improve myself on. So that was kind of the my expectation at that time. But yes, I at the beginning, it was just a bunch of guys. I think I was probably employee number, I don't know, 30, 40 at the time. So the company was already there, and I was introduced to some of the people that you mentioned. We would have coffee together. We would talk about, you know, we were on probably on different projects, and we would kind of share thoughts about what we were building. And it was immediately, I mean, everything clicked. Everyone was, I felt I was surrounded by smart people, since the beginning. And there was something special in retrospect about how everyone was different but talented in different ways. And that cross-pollination was perfect for everyone, I think. So in retrospect, I don't know what was the kind of the reason why that happened, but I think we all clicked in a way and helped each other become, you know, better professionals.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it seems like, you know, everyone's gone on to do pretty much pretty amazing things. And it just seems like there was a special formula for whoever was doing the recruitment at that time did a good job.
Yes.
So you came into the market, you didn't know Salesforce, you quickly were sent off on a course to learn to be an admin. At what point do you feel you became an architect?
So I was, in a way, challenging myself outside the role of a developer. And I quickly realized that to become a better developer, I had to rethink my perspective on things. So as a developer, I was used to be assigned the task and get it done of course, I mean, it's not as simple as that. It's a problem solving at the end of the day job. And there is a lot of beauty in that job. But I wasn't really looking at the big picture, right? So, but what I started doing differently, I started caring about the success of my customers more than I ever did before, right? So I started becoming the person that will go and fix a project when the project maybe wasn't going so well. And I actually, at some point, I felt that I would go on many of these projects at once and really do my best to work with the team to drive things and drive improvements in the right way to make sure that the project at the end of the day was successful. And doing that helped me learn, and I would say, leave a little bit the perspective of the developer and embrace a bit more the point of view of the customer. You know, technology is not something that you do for the sake of it. It's something that you do to serve a business purpose. And that comes with a set of entirely different challenges, right? So exposure to that, and I think aligning to that perspective more and more, while at the same time solving technical challenges at greater and greater scales, helped me make the leap. And I guess that I think I understood that I was there when I was working on this very large project, large investment in Salesforce, large investment in services. And I was leading that engagement at the time. And so there were a few driving forces there, right? So there was the business that was investing this very, very large amount of money, a lot of stakes on this implementation to be successful. It was a global rollout. And also there was the engineering team at that time that was working at the company that was entirely hostile to Salesforce. They didn't want the project to happen. They felt threatened about us. They felt threatened about the change in technology. And so I was kind of stuck in the middle. And at some point, I managed to slowly become a trusted advisor to both. So at some point, I realized I was both helping the business in achieving their goals, gaining the trust of the development team. And that was just because I was helping solve all these problems. I mean, it wasn't just myself. I was just, you know, orchestrating things, helping. We were a team at the end of the day. But the realization that I managed somehow to be a facilitator for these opposing forces made me realize, well, I think I reached something that I hadn't reached before. I feel that I'm a better professional now. And this is what I probably should call being an architect. Sure. And that was a moment where I thought I probably should get to do my CTA.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll talk about the journey to CTA shortly, but you also have managed teams, which is also something that I find it quite challenging to find someone that does want to be a CTA and someone that wants to manage teams and combine them together, because often people that want to go down the CTA path feel that they have to really 100% focus on that. So did you manage teams before you became a CTA, or did that come afterwards?
I did before. As always, that was part of me looking for improving and learning new things. And that was an aspect that I had never experienced before. So I think it all started for me learning agile methodologies in a rigorous way. So a big part of running Salesforce implementation was also being exposed to a new methodology of work for me, which was agile and Scrum in particular. And I decided to learn it and embrace it in a rigorous way. And by doing that, I learned that this was a very effective framework to manage all the day-to-day challenges that come out of managing a team of people. And that gave me a framework that helped me start managing small teams first, and then gradually larger and larger teams. So managing teams from a point of view of technical leadership is something that I learned in this ecosystem before becoming a CTA. And then, of course, there is also the managing people as a manager. And that was an entire different thing that I experienced before becoming a technical a CTA. And that is yet another level of management that comes with an entire set of different challenges.
Sure.
But I think that goes beyond your question, right?
Yeah. But also, I mean, that's probably the part that a lot of people don't want to do, because it takes away from their focus around, you know, being on a project and being an architect. Did any of that help you, do you think, in your journey? Like, is there anything you could pinpoint that, you know, even patience or something like that, I guess, like that you learn from managing other people that can help you be a better architect?
I think so. I mean, this is probably something that I'm not sure many people think about this, but I believe that there is a big part in this job is empathy. And I mean, I don't mean it in a, I mean, it sounds like a very unusual thing to say, but you need to understand and empathize with different type of people and different driving forces, and understand what are their goals, even in the context of a business transaction, of a business project, right? Empathy is a big, big weapon you can use to understand people's motivation and try to drive the best possible outcome to everyone. And management teaches you that. You cannot be a successful manager if you don't empathize with people. If you don't understand what you truly understand what their motivations are, because you cannot be a good manager without that part. And so that's training that part of your brain that is greatly beneficial even for all the set of soft skills that you need to develop to become an architect.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like, I've never thought of it like that, but it makes so much sense. And I think that's a very good tip for a lot of people that are going on that journey, not just to focus on the technology and being an architect on as many projects as possible, but also how they interact with others that they can empathize with and kind of learn from, as well as to how to manage and have conversations with. So yeah, that's interesting.
This episode of Talent Hub Talk is sponsored by our friends from Flow Republic. Flow Republic is a Salesforce Architect Academy that works with individuals and businesses to upskill and prepare Salesforce architects for the CTA review board. They also have a number of other offerings, including coaching and guiding on areas such as soft skills, consulting, and design training. Flow Republic are some of the brightest minds in the Salesforce ecosystem and have a proven track record of developing Salesforce professionals and helping architects to reach their goal of becoming a CTA. To find out more about the value they can add, please check out flowrepublic.com.
And then looking at the CTA journey, so you just delivered this global project, you knew the time was right. How did that journey shape up and what did it look like for you?
It was a lot of work and practice. A lot of study for me. At that time, I was feeling that. So at that time, I was about to have my first children. So I kind of rushed in a little bit, and that wasn't the right thing to do, right? So I had to learn to take the time that I needed, the process. So at that time, the CTA, the domain exams weren't there at that time. So there was this massive, there were three stages in the exam itself. There was, and before the review board, there was this part that was the multiple choice exam. And it was very easy to felt after doing part two, felt you were ready for part three. But in reality, there is this incredible, massive gap between being ready, being eligible for the board, and being ready for the board. It's two incredibly different things. And it's easy to, overlook that. So I did that mistake. But what I learned is basically going back to taking the time that I needed. So, I mean, it's so many things. It's hard to find a specific receipt for, you know, preparing for the CTA board. I think so many people talk about this. There are so many great, you know, posts, so many great resources out there to help architects get ready. So I think there is nothing special that I can add. For me, the big thing was about earning the confidence and earning the familiarizing with all the aspects of the. I mean, I feel I had a good enough understanding of the platform, all the different components, all the different parts. So I was happy and I felt ready from that point of view. The big part that was hard for me and that I had to do a lot of preparation for was really training myself to really, you know, think on my feet, be able to be very, very quick and react to challenges and questions about my solution and defend it in a way that was at the level that was expected.
Sure.
Okay. So I think that for me, the journey was, there was a lot of study involved, a lot of practice involved, because you really need to be ready, right? You know that they are, the range of questions that are going to ask you is incredible, is very, very broad. So I wasn't much worried about the depth of the questions. I was more worried about the breadth of the questions. And I needed to make sure that I covered everything. So the preparation is just long for that. And if you do this while you are exposed to the right project, the right challenges, and your role is at that level, I think it's the perfect moment. It's very important to do this, I would say, with a scientific approach in terms of all the stuff that you need to learn. But at the same time, you need to back this with the right experience on the job. You need to be exposed to the right project and need to be in the right role for sure.
Sure. Can you remember how you felt when you passed?
I think it was a big moment of relief, because this waiting time between the moment you leave the room and the moment you get the email, it feels like an eternity. So, you know, you find yourself constantly checking your phone for emails. And it was a relief, because I felt I did well when I left the room. And I was confident that I had a good chance. But, you know, just receiving the email that you were, you know, waiting for so long, it was a big moment of joy for me, and also a big relief not having to do the whole ordeal again.
Yeah, I can imagine. So so you're no longer in consulting. You now own and run your own business. Can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of where the whole business came from?
Sure. So I started the company, a product company called Clayton. What we do is we do automated code reviews for Salesforce. What we do is we basically help engineering teams build on the platform, wasting less time and shipping better product. So we build this technology that what it does is reviews the code that developers write and make sure it's robust, secure, and scalable, plus a few other things, so they don't have to do it, right? And they can spend their time in a more meaningful way and, you know, building more features for the products. So that's what we do. And it all started, of course, from my experience as an architect and in this space. I've been part of fixing projects, was also setting up the right development process. It's a part of the CTA, but it's also a big part of driving the success of any implementation, is nailing the development lifecycle. And at that time, there weren't so many products out there to, you know, help streamline it. And one of the biggest gaps, in my opinion, was the fact that to make things really successful and robust and scalable, you had to go, I would always do a checklist of things to check. And I would always have a moment of peer reviews with my developers, or encourage developers to do this amongst themselves, always basing things on a checklist. And this checklist grew and grew and grew, and it was always the same things. And the challenge was that some of these checks needed a lot of time, and there wasn't any tool to automate these things, but they, in my mind, were very automatable because they were always the same things. So that's what suggested me, maybe I should build something that does this, so that, you know, people don't have to go through this thing over and over again. And when they have conversation about their code, when they peer review their code, they have more meaningful conversations and don't waste too much time on repetitive stuff. So I've started it as an experiment, kind of on a side project. And at that time, I did a submission for a Dreamforce talk about the idea, and that got selected. I did a session with Robert Soseman, which was another guy that I didn't know at the time, but was working on similar ideas. So that was a moment where I basically built my prototype, showed it to the public, and the room was packed, and two or three people came to me and say, "Hey, we really have this problem. We would love to use your little thing here." And so I got my first three customers out of there, and that gave me the, you know, the courage to say, okay, maybe this is a thing I should pursue.
Sure. Yeah, well.
And that's how it started.
And in terms of the like, I'm not technical at all, but I often hear people complaining about bad quality code, or, you know, people that have rushed through test classes and ultimately have left a client in a worse place. But like, what would you say the general quality of code that you've seen over the years has been in customers? And what's typically the reason for poor code?
I actually can answer this quite scientifically, because we are now at the point where we process a lot of code. And so we have a fairly good idea of what quality looks like in this ecosystem. So first of all, about code quality is a broad term, right? And it's easy to be subjective about it. But in reality, the way I interpret code quality is not, bad code quality to me is not something that I would do differently, is rather something that is damaging a customer to some degree.
Sure.
Okay. So poor quality is either because you have introduced something that will cause a problem of any sort. Testing is one area where if you don't do things well, you basically have to pay it back, as you mentioned. Security is another aspect. Sometimes, you know, it's not strictly code quality, but it's kind of a related topic. But if your code has some problems related to security, of course, there is a business risk involved. So you have to go back and fix it, right? So this is a generic, broader term that it's easy to go subjectively about, but to me is quite a scientific thing. So at least I deal with it this way. And it is, in fact, something that, so we scan roughly half a billion lines of code per day, give or take. And we see actually a little bit of some, we see some patterns, right? So in terms of how developers write code, and there is this metric that we look at that is called defect density. So what we do is we look at different aspects. We look at things like testing. We look at things like scalability. We look at things like security. We perform a set of tests, but regardless what the tests are, we come up with a number that is how much effort is required to fix that thing, to fix security, to fix performance, to fix scalability, or whatever it is. And if we divide that by the number of lines of code, we can tell you on average for every line, you have 3 hours to fix or 50 hours to fix. And what the reason why I'm telling you this is because this is a very good indication that on the state of this ecosystem from the point of view of the code quality, because we know that, for example, performance is something that typically team get right. So performance are hardly a problem. And if you think about it, it makes sense because there is a lot of education about development best practices around governor limits. The message is so clear and so well absorbed by the community of developers. It's very, very rare to find problems in that area. And in fact, we find typically very low defect density. So problems are, if exist, they are very spread out. And mostly they are not affecting, you know, implementations or apps. But it's a different story when it comes to testing and security. Those aspects are by far the worst. And so I think we see security problem in roughly 66% of implementations, if I remember correctly, which is huge if you think about it, because I think it's a topic no one really discusses, but it would deserve much more attention. It's how, because the platform is so flexible, it's also possible technically to, you know, introduce security flaws, but it's not a topic that is often discussed. And so that's a big, big thing that we see, but also testing, as you correctly say, what's common is that we see that there are either a lot of missing tests. So that means that it's hard to go back and change the behavior of something without breaking something else. And you lose agility if you are in that situation because you basically have to, you know, do more human tests, more regression tests. It's really hard to understand if a behavior is intentional or not. Mm-hmm. If you're building the behavior of something you built. And of course, it's challenged by turnover even more because this is an ecosystem where people come and go all the time. So after, you know, the developer that has built something left, if you don't have the test there, you basically don't know what that was supposed to do. So that's something that we see. And in terms of the reasons why, I think it's a set of factors. The biggest probably thing is that businesses expect value quickly because one big selling point of Salesforce is like the time to value and the time to market are shortened. And that sets the expectation that you should build as quickly as possible. But sometimes it's easy to overlook some of the non-functional aspects of building robust solutions. That might be a reason, right? So I think this is probably why. And then, of course, maybe the fact that people, that the ecosystem is driven by consultants a lot. Ultimately, even if we start seeing different models now, historically, consultants were, you know, just paid by the hour. And that means that, yeah, maybe if you leave something that is not optimal, the customer will figure that out and ultimately be upset about it. But maybe it's not that important. It's more important to just get the job done. But I have to say that we now see more partners embracing different models where they start, you know, maybe taking a stake in the success of the project in the long-term success. And so there are different pricing models also in the way consulting companies work that are better to drive quality solutions, right?
Sure.
So I think that's the answer that I have for you.
And also, obviously, you're technical, right? So you've always been technical and you understand the ramifications and what can go wrong by having bad code in the system. But not every hiring manager and not every company really know what they're getting when they hire a Salesforce developer.
Yep.
Obviously, some do. They're technical. They can ask the right questions. They can even do code reviews themselves. But some people don't have that ability. What is the risk to a business of having bad tests or security is a fairly obvious one, right? But what do you see as the biggest risks to companies if they don't know that they've got these problems in their code?
Security, of course, as you say, it's obvious. So there is a direct risk on reputation and compliance. You're putting a lot of data in the cloud, in this platform. Maybe you have a community. You cannot really afford to have a security flaw, because that will put your entire business at risk. But that's, I agree, it's a separate conversation. Code quality is more subtle. But what happens is that the major, there are many aspects that can be impacted, but I would say by far the major is the loss of capacity and the loss of agility. So in short, if you have a very strong quality in your team versus if you have bad quality, the time that you need to build the same thing changes. Because as you can imagine, if the quality of my code is bad, it will take me longer to build the same thing. And so there is a kind of a leakage in capacity. If you have a very poor quality, this compounds. And it will take longer. So you are basically losing capacity. You're hiring 10 developers, but you don't have the capacity of 10 developers. You are losing some of that capacity to the bad quality that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one aspect. But I think there are also kind of secondary impacts. A poor quality will also educate your team to kind of create a precedence that that's okay. And so your team will be drawn whenever they are challenged by deadline to consider acceptable to compromise on quality, which is, of course, causing this effect to compound. And the other thing is that I've seen personally is that developers, and this goes back to managing people, actually, developers can actually not enjoy their work if they work in an environment where quality is not seen as a priority. They will end up at some point not wanting to work there anymore, because no one wants to do a bad job, right? So even if they're paid well, at some point money stops being a motivator, and there is a different drives that come into play, and doing a good job is one of it for everyone.
Sure.
It's one of them. So one aspect is it also is demotivating to people, and it's easier to get higher turnover if your quality is very bad. So I would say primary impact is you basically waste a lot of money because you waste capacity. Secondary impact is that you can expect having a higher turnover of people because people will inevitably leave.
Sure. But I guess you can't always have a team of tequila people, right? So there's always going to be some people that aren't at the same level of expertise as others. If there is a team where you've got, three superstars writing great quality code, and then you've got one person struggling and cutting corners, perhaps, and trying to keep up, and does that still have a significant impact on the business and the team, or can the rest of them cover and kind of carry someone writing bad quality code?
Well, I think that goes back to having a healthy development process where you can actually embrace, help people cross skills. So code reviews are central to this. Code reviews are central to this because having code reviews pretty much encourages everyone to have their code checked by their peers or by someone else before the code is considered complete. So that's a concept that I truly believe and embrace since the beginning of my career. And I believe that that's key to mitigating that risk. You mentioned this correctly, but I don't think it's never, there's nothing wrong in having to learn, right? There is no shame in not being yet at your full potential. That's absolutely okay. And that's where having a good engineering team and embracing good engineering practice will help you become better. And we go back to that point, as you see, right? Driving people to become a better version of themselves professionally, that's a secret sauce for success. So that can also be I think this is something that is a big part for every decision. If you as a developer feel that you have a lot to learn and feel that maybe you're not reached your full potential, I think a consideration on how working in a team will help you bridge that gap and learn more, even by virtue of the process they have, I think that's a big factor in your decision. It should be a big factor in your decision.
And just one other question on code reviews. If a company has one developer, only one Salesforce developer, what's the workaround there?
Get Clayton. That's a workaround. So, well, the code reviews are, you need at least two people to do them. And we obviously cannot replace a human. We can automate stuff. We can automate all the repetitive stuff. So if you have only one developer, it's very good to use Clayton. Of course, here I cannot. It's very hard for me not to say this.
Of course.
We created the product exactly for that. But regardless, even if you have a very powerful automation that takes a lot of these problems away, there's nothing that will replace and remove the benefits of having another peer reviewing your code and sharing their advice, because that's just such a powerful way for people to connect on something they're building and share their opinions in a way that makes everyone's better. So I would say we can help you, but really the best thing you can do is hire another developer.
Sure. Well, that plays into my strengths as well, so thanks for mentioning that. So finally, you've had an amazing career. You've obviously achieved a huge amount, and you've got your own business, and a lot of people want to go down that product route. A lot of people want to be a CTA, but it all started with being a really good developer. So what's your best piece of advice for a new Salesforce developer right now that wants to go on to achieve great things?
I would say never stop learning. I think that the key thing is learn something until you're comfortable with that, and then leave your comfort zone and learn something new. I think that's a big, big thing. That's the biggest advice for me, and that the one that served me, that helped me the most. Try to, I would say, surround yourself with the smartest people that you can. If you feel that you are the smartest person in a room, leave that room and look for another one. I think that's an important thing. Being empathetic is also a very important piece of advice that I would give. As a developer, developers are typically very smart, and smart people have very strong opinions. It's kind of natural, right? So it's easy for us to miss the empathy bit, but I feel that is the secret weapon to become a better professional and grow in someone's career. I think that's a very important part. And probably don't waste your time solving the wrong problems. It's when you are a developer, you like challenges, but sometimes not every challenge is the same. Sometimes you are you might be doing something that is not, it maybe is a little bit reinventing the wheel, is not your talent, and your intelligence can be better used in solving problems that are worth solving, that haven't been solved yet. Sure. So I think these are the three pieces of advice that I would share.
Yeah, well, look, thank you so much. I think you've provided a lot of value, both for developers, people that want to be CTAs, but also customers that are lacking a product like yours in their suite, because code quality and like you said, code reviews are so important. So we'll share the company details, but if anyone wants to reach out to you directly to ask any questions, where do you spend your time online?
You can find me on Twitter, on LinkedIn. On Twitter, I am LoFrattini, LoFrattini. I try to stay off of social media just because I find them very distracting and I need to get a lot of stuff done in my day. But I really enjoy connecting with people and sharing advice when asked. So feel free to connect to me. And if there's anything that I can help you with, just feel free to reach out.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. And I really, really enjoyed catching up, and all the best for what's to come.
Thank you. Thanks, Ben. Have a good day. Thank you for having me. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talent Hub Talk. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and also leave a short review. We're keen for this podcast to reach as many people in the Salesforce ecosystem as possible, and your reviews will help us do that.